The Da Vinci Code, an Old Testament Messianic Prophecy by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. The Old Testament prophecies regarding coming Messiah are fulfilled in history in such a way as to show that the canonical Gospels in the New Testament are historical and that the reconstruction of Jesus in the Da Vinci Code is not. Let's have a look. One of the big differences between Gnosticism and Christianity is their views of the Old Testament. And as you may be aware, Dan Brown in his mystery thriller, The Da Vinci Code, treats the Gnostic materials as the real story regarding Jesus and such. But one of the big differences between Gnosticism and Christianity is their views of the Old Testament. Christianity viewed itself as in continuity with and in fulfillment of the Old Testament. Gnosticism viewed the Old Testament as basically mistaken, since the Creator God in Gnosticism is viewed as a lesser, rather ignorant being, and that the God that the Gnostics worshipped was far above the Creator God. The Da Vinci Code tends to side with Gnosticism here, since it views goddess worship and sexual rites as part of authentic Judaism, in spite of Old Testament condemnations. Well, how can we test the past? How can we decide which of these is authentic? Well, without time machines, how can we really know what happened in the past? Isn't it just one group's word against another's? No. God has given us a better basis for assurance than this. One important line of evidence is a supernatural fit between the Old and New Testaments. We can see that the New Testament Gospels are in continuity with the Old Testament, unlike the Gnostic Gospels and unlike the Da Vinci Code. Even liberal New Testament scholars admit that Jesus died by crucifixion somewhere around AD 30, that his resurrection was believed immediately, and that Paul gives us a very early picture of the meaning of Jesus' death. Astonishingly, these features all fit the predictions of the Old Testament. Isaiah 42 and 49 tell us about the Messiah as a light to the nations. Daniel 9 tells us about the time of his execution. Psalm 22 tells us about the nature of his execution. And Isaiah 53 tells us about the meaning of his execution and his resurrection. Let's see. In Isaiah chapter 42, verses 6 and 7, a section of Isaiah from chapter 40 to chapter 53 is called the servant section of Isaiah because of this mysterious figure, the servant, who shows up here, who at some points is identified with Israel, but other points is clearly distinguished from Israel. Well, in Isaiah chapter 42, 6 and 7, we have God speaking, and he says to the servant, I will appoint you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, and those who dwell in darkness from the prison. Further on, in Isaiah 49, verses 5 and 6, the servant is quoting God here speaking, and he says, And now says the Lord who formed me from the womb to be a servant, to bring Jacob back to him, in order that Israel might be gathered to him. He says, It is too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also make you a light to the nations so that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. Well, this fits Jesus in a rather striking way. Of the many people who have claimed to be Messiah over the centuries, he is the only one who has started a world religion of Gentiles. Before Jesus came, few non-Jews were believers in a single God, much less the God of the Bible. Now nearly half the Gentiles in the world believe in the God of Abraham. No one but God could engineer this. Daniel 9 tells us something about the time of the execution of the Messiah. Daniel 9, verses 25 and 26 of the passage we'll be quoting. A little background. Daniel has realized from his study of the prophet Jeremiah that the captivity of Israel is to last 70 years, the Babylonian captivity. And he realizes that 70 years must be nearly up. And he begins to pray to God that God would forgive him and the Israel and the nation, and that he would restore them. And the book of Daniel tells us an angel came to him with this message. Know and understand this, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Anointed One, that's the Hebrew word for Messiah, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. It, presumably Jerusalem, will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble, after the 62 sevens, the Anointed One will be cut off and will have nothing. Well, we see from this that the Messiah was to come after the 69th Sabbath cycle. The unit of time measurement here appears to be cycles of sabbatical years, here translated as sevens, and in the King James translated as weeks. The Israelites, you may or may not remember, were commanded to rest every one day out of every seven, but they were also commanded to let their land rest one year out of every seven. And so this set up a sabbatical cycle in which the year, which the land was farmed 6 years, and then the land rested on the seventh year. Unlike our crop rotation, this was not done in such a way that some land was working every year, but all of the land got off, if you like, once every 7 years. The starting point for this prediction in Daniel 9 seems to be the command of King Artaxerxes I in his 20th year, 445 B.C., in which he sends Nehemiah back to village now at Jerusalem and allows Nehemiah to rebuild the walls around Jerusalem, which will make it fortified and therefore make it a city in ancient parlance. The sabbatical cycle in which the starting point falls is now known to be 449 to 442 B.C. We've known from ancient times that the sabbatical cycle started in the fall of the year, and in recent years, investigation of the archaeological material has been done and has determined what set of 7 years represents which years in the sabbatical cycle. And this particular sabbatical cycle would have started in the fall of 449 B.C. and ended in the fall of 442 B.C. Using the usual inclusive method of counting, which the Jews used, that is, the unit of time in which an event occurred would be counted as the first unit, and then the next unit would be the second, the third, and the fourth, etc. The 69th cycle from here would be 28 to 35 A.D. Here's what it looks like on the chart, with the blue bars representing the sabbatical cycles and the numbers above them representing the starting and ending years. The blue arrow representing Artaxerxes' decree in 445 B.C., and the cross representing Jesus' crucifixion in 30 A.D., and you see that Jesus' crucifixion occurs during the 69th sabbatical cycle from when this started. So, this 69th week, by the way, 28 to 35 A.D., covers all standard dates for Jesus' crucifixion. Some put it as early as 29 and some as late as 33. Isn't it strange that the only messianic claimant who started a world religion of Gentiles just happened to be cut off in the time range specified centuries in advance? Psalm 22 on the nature of the Messiah's execution. Why did Jesus cry out from the cross, my God, why have you abandoned me? Well, there are a number of answers to that. Christian theology tells us that he was abandoned by God because God had placed upon him the sins of the world, etc. But he's also quoting Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is a very interesting psalm. It tells of a person who's been abandoned by God, who is surrounded by his enemies, whose hands and feet are pierced, whose clothes have been gambled away, who is thirsty, whose bones are out of joint, who is laid in the dust of death. This not only describes crucifixion, but was written at a time before crucifixion existed. It also described Jesus' crucifixion very much in particular. Here's a condensed summary of the text of Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. They lay me in the dust of death. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men has encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. That's what the first 18 verses or so of the psalm look like. It's a psalm calling out to God for rescue, a psalm in which there's sorrow and pain and such. The last 10 verses or so of the psalm have a very different atmosphere, calm, a psalm of praise, etc., and that's where we pick up here in our condensed version. I will declare your name to my brothers. In the congregation I will praise you. The poor will eat and be satisfied. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, for he has done it. This last half of the psalm, or last third of the psalm, is rather puzzling. Change in atmosphere, reference occasionally to eating, etc. It appears, as you look over it carefully, reference to the great congregation, etc., it appears that it pictures a person standing in the temple and carrying out the final features of the vow ceremony. So perhaps, in a sense, carrying out the ceremonies about what he had vowed while he was forsaken by God. And that fits the eating and the congregation and all of those things which were a part of the vow ceremony, in which the offerer, the person who had made the vow and whose prayer had been answered by God, brings a sacrificial animal to the temple. The animal's killed and skinned and all of that sort of thing, and part of it is put on the altar and burnt up, but a big hunk of it comes back to the worshiper. And he basically cooks it and has a celebratory meal with his friends. And that seems to be the picture that we see here in Psalm 22. Psalm 22 tells us about this regarding the Messiah's execution. The psalm goes on to note that God does answer him and rescue him, that these events will be remembered all over the world and down through the generations. And this is just what happened in the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus. We turn to Isaiah 53 on the meaning of the Messiah's execution. Here we have the famous prophecy of someone's death and resurrection. He's God's servant. It's the climax section of the big servant section in Isaiah, from Isaiah 40 to 53. We see that God's servant is rejected by humans. He's despised by Israel. He dies for their sins. He is raised to life again. He is exalted by God, and this fits what the New Testament says about Jesus. Let's look at it rather quickly, all of the verses. The passage actually starts in the last verses of Isaiah 52, verses 13 and following, where it says, "See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likenesses. So he will sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand." In these verses, we see that God's servant will be highly exalted. He will be disfigured so that many are appalled at him. He will sprinkle many nations. I want to make of that. Well, sprinkling was a standard cleansing ceremony in the Old Testament. So he will cleanse many nations. Kind of parallel to the remark about being a light to the Gentiles in the Isaiah 9 passage. And Isaiah 53, 1 through 3 goes on, "Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not." These verses tell us, who would have believed it? So there's something unusual about this. The servant has no beauty or majesty. Don't know whether we're to understand that as true of the whole career of the servant, or particularly of this incident where he is put to death. He's despised and rejected. He's sorrowful and suffering. We go on to verses 4 through 6. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. These verses tell us that the servant carried our sorrows, was punished for our sins, but we thought God was punishing him because of what he had done. By his punishment we are healed and have peace. Going on to verses 7 and 8, he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. These verses tell us the servant is strangely silent when oppressed. He is put to death by unjust judgment. His death was to pay for the transgressions of, quote, my people, unquote. Verses 9 and 10 say, he was assigned a grave with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death, because he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. These verses tell us that though they planned to bury him with wicked men, he was actually with a rich man in his death. God caused his suffering, making his life a guilt offering. Afterward, the servant will prolong his days. The last two verses of our passage say, after the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By knowledge of him, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion with the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. These last two verses tell us, after suffering he will be satisfied. After death he will live. Many will be justified by knowing him. He will be counted among the great. Though considered a transgressor, he actually bore their sins and made intercession for them. So, Isaiah 53 on the meaning of his execution. In Isaiah 53 we're told that God's servant will be rejected by humans, despised by Israel, killed for their sins, raised to life again, exalted by God. This fits what the New Testament says about Jesus. In fact, it matches the New Testament doctrine of the atonement. One can even say it is the basis for the New Testament doctrine of the atoning value of Jesus' death. It was written centuries in advance. Conclusions on Messianic prophecy. So the features of the New Testament picture of Jesus fit Old Testament prophecy in many ways that could not have been engineered by his followers. Many of these could not have been faked by recording fulfillments in the New Testament where none occurred in history. Thus there was a vital supernatural connection between Old Testament and New Testament as we have them. The Da Vinci Code has no such connections in its allegations about Jesus and early Christianity. It is based upon claims and suppositions for which there is no real evidence. There is no reason to believe it is good history for the first century of the Christian era. Further reading, see our work, The Evidence of Prophecy, and see Kenny Barfield's book, The Prophet Motive, Examining the Reliability of the Biblical Prophets. The end. Old Testament Messianic prophecy is fulfilled in the New Testament and in history. It is not in the Da Vinci Code.